You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
Just gone 7 minutes past 12 o'clock. Good afternoon from me, Ray White, in for Stephen Croesus on the Midday Report. Well, coming up on the program in the next hour, questions remain about the bridge collapse while one person is still in a critical condition in hospital. Women's rights groups say the re-establishment of sexual offences courts will restore faith in the criminal judicial system. We take a closer look at this. And the judge in the Ahmed Timmel inquest has questions for earlier witnesses. Talking to Eyewitness News reporter Barry Bateman about this developing news story a little bit later on. And Disney wants to have its own streaming service. What does this mean for Netflix? Very interesting. I'd like to hear from you on these and other stories as well. You can SMS on 31702 or 31567. You can also tweet on @RayWhiteSA. Also, don't forget to follow the Midday Report by visiting our 702 and Cape Talk websites. Let's go to our top story now. And Deputy Higher Education Minister Mduduzi Manana is appearing in the Randburg Magistrates Court this afternoon. Manana admitted to assaulting Mandisa Duma at a nightclub in Four Ways. That was in the early hours of Sunday morning. Police Minister Fikile Mbalula is also due to speak on the matter at a media briefing in about an hour's time. On the line is Eyewitness News reporter Tando Kobeka. Good afternoon, Tando. Take us to exactly what's happened so far then.
Good afternoon, Ray. Manana has arrived for his court appearance here at the Randburg Magistrates Court, where he will be officially charged with assault. We understand that he was presented with a summons to appear in court earlier this week. Police Minister Fikile Mbalula, of course, saying that. So we were told by some officials earlier today, Ray, to wait for Mduduzi Manana at the front entrance of the courthouse, which is where we were expecting him to come in, but Manana didn't do so. It appears he was snuck in through, you know, while a contingent of journalists, you know, we waited for him outside, of course, raising questions of, you know, preferential treatment. And we obviously got a tip-off that he was inside the premises, and we spotted him walking through the corridors of the courthouse, you know, wearing a navy blue tailored suit. He was being escorted by court officials, and then he was taken to a secluded area where it appears that, you know, they're still hashing out things that has to do with the case. I'm not sure really what's been happening, but they've been in there with court officials for about an hour now before, of course, he appears in front of the magistrates this afternoon.
Tando, any protesters there?
Well, a few women are here, Ray. I spotted them outside wearing T-shirts written "Not in my name." Of course, they're here to, you know, protest against the abuse of women. And also, I haven't also spotted the woman herself who was assaulted, Mandisa Duma, or family members. But of course, we've had calls mounting for Manana to be fired from opposition parties, civil society groups, and we also had President Jacob Zuma yesterday speaking out against the abuse of women at that government official celebration for Women's Day, you know, saying despite of anybody's position in society, they must face the full might of the law.
Eyewitness News reporter Tando Kobeka on the line from the Randburg Magistrates Court. The Democratic Alliance in Parliament is not backing down after losing the motion of no confidence against President Jacob Zuma. The opposition has announced that it intends later today to table a motion to dissolve the National Assembly in terms of Section 50 of the Constitution. So how does this work? And after the no confidence motion, is there going to be any prospect of success? On the line is Eyewitness News parliamentary reporter Gay Davis. Good afternoon, Gay. Take us through exactly what the DA wants then.
Hi, Ray. Well, what the DA wants is the majority of MPs in the House to back this motion that it will be tabling later today. That doesn't mean that it's going to be dealt with by Parliament today. It would only get dealt with in terms of the program, have to be programmed, put on the program, and eventually be debated. But they would need a majority of MPs in the House to support this motion in terms of Section 50 of the Constitution, which says the President must dissolve the National Assembly if it has the support of the majority of MPs. And 3 years have passed since the last elections. But the DA has not got the support of a number of the smaller parties, including the EFF, the UDM, COPE, all say they won't back such a motion. So the chances of this motion, unless the DA is able to persuade them to support it, looks as though it's dead in the water. They have a right to do this, as Bontholomiso, the UDM leader, told me this morning. They've got a right to pursue whatever they want to in their political agenda. He says it wasn't discussed with opposition parties. And I find it quite interesting because we've heard a lot from the DA about the power a combined opposition or united opposition would have. And I find it strange that this wasn't fully discussed with the other opposition parties before the DA decided to make its move.
Well, it's very interesting. So say, let's play devil's advocate. So say, for instance, all the other opposition parties agree to play along. Then I suppose the DA then would want another secret ballot.
Well, I'm not sure that would be necessary, they might want that to cover ANC MPs who might vote or want to vote in favour of such a motion. But the thing is the EFF's Julius Malema said, well, you know, that the DA MPs should rather just resign en masse and that would force early elections. It seems as though that is not the case. The DA is saying that that's based on a misreading of the Constitution, and I think that other constitutional law experts agree on this, that it would simply leave the ANC in the House as the majority party and that there would still be sufficient numbers to create the quorum needed to perform the tasks of the National Assembly, and that the section that Malema referred to actually just deals with the upper and lower levels of numbers of MPs needed for the House to do its business. Mm-hmm. Is this just a move perhaps to keep the fires burning after the no confidence vote in the President was defeated, albeit by a very narrow margin? We'll see how it unfolds. It's going to take time before it actually works its way onto the program of the National Assembly, even if they do get that motion sent through to the table later today.
Eyewitness News parliamentary correspondent or reporter Gay Davis on the line from Cape Town. Let's stay with the story now, and joining us is constitutional law expert Professor Pierre de Vos. Good afternoon, Professor. Welcome to the show. The DA is certainly not giving up, are they?
Yes, they're not giving up, but what they are proposing is, of course, has absolutely no chance whatsoever of ever being successful, because they are wanting 201 MPs to vote to dissolve Parliament, which is provided for in the Constitution. But that would mean about 50 or 60 ANC MPs will have to vote for an early election, something that even the most ardent critics inside the ANC of President Jacob Zuma is never going to do now before the December elective conference. So that motion, they can table it, they have every right to do so, it's never going to pass.
Right, then let's look at what happens next month. And this whole matter is going to the appeals court. I'm talking about the charges against President Jacob Zuma. If the appeals court then rules against him, what happens next?
Well, if what is being challenged is the decision of the National Prosecuting Authority to drop the charges. The Prosecuting Authority had decided to institute charges against President Zuma. So if the court now says that decision is invalid and that is confirmed, then it is as if the original decision by the NPA arises from the dead, so to speak, and there is again a decision to charge the president, then the NPA has two options. It can either then go to court and formally charge the president, or it can, well, three options really. It can, of course, appeal the matter to the Constitutional Court also, or the third thing is it can then again decide to drop the charges, but this time using reasons that are actually rational and constitutionally valid. Whether there are such reasons will be interesting to know.
Yeah, I was about to ask you, are there those reasons? But let's say, for instance, it then goes to the Constitutional Court. What happens to President Jacob Zuma? At what point does he have to say, I'm facing serious charges, I need to step aside?
Well, I'm not sure the president is going to step aside voluntarily, even if he faces serious charges. But how the law works is the decision only becomes operational once the appeals process is exhausted or once people stop appealing. So if the Supreme Court of Appeal, say, argument for argument's sake, they rule against the president, then if he then decides to appeal the matter, then that decision of the SCA doesn't kick in immediately. It will be suspended until the Constitutional Court hear the case, and only then will it actually kick in, and then the NPA, of course, is going to be faced with this problem again of either having to prosecute the president or finding some other reasons to drop the charges against him.
We got a long way to go. Constitutional law expert Professor Pierre de Vos, thanks for your time this afternoon on the Midday Report.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
Coming up to 21 minutes past 12 o'clock, and the city of Ekurhuleni has appointed a committee that will look at all other bridges in that area to ensure safety after a bridge collapsed at the N3 Geldenes interchange early on yesterday morning. Five people were injured when three trucks and a car crashed into the bridge. Keeping an eye on the story is Eyewitness News reporter Mia Lindeke. Good afternoon, Mia. Traffic back to normal this morning. It was a very quick turnaround, wasn't it, for those clearing the fallen bridge?
That's correct. Yes, Ray. I was at this specific spot with the Transport Minister, Sunrail CEO, and Gauteng Transport NEC. They visited this area this morning at about just before 7, just before that peak traffic. The road was reopened just after midnight, and initially engineers estimated that it would take them about 2 days. That would be by the end of this afternoon. But luckily they moved very quickly and they removed all the rubble from the road, because this is a very busy road and engineers worked around the clock. The Transport Minister says that they are actually not aware of those who will be suing them, but they will take all this matter to the legal department, because that's now the next concern, you know, if anyone will be pursuing legal charges against them. Some of them are still in hospital. But everything is back to normal now, and we just have some of the patients, or those who have been injured, Ray, who are still in hospital.
Mia, there were initial reports of an earth tremor. What else do we know?
Yes, Ray. Well, preliminary investigations have shown that the bridge did not collapse because of any structural problems. At this moment, it is not yet known what may have caused it, but Sunrail said to me that they think that it's external factors. It's nothing to do with the bridge, because apparently the bridge was built in 1978, so it's about 40 years old. So it is very old, but he says that apparently the last inspection was in July last year and everything was fine. There was no problem with it. And at the time when this bridge collapsed, no one was actually using it. Of course, there is now also an investigation by the Labor Department, and they'll be looking into all the details.
Mia, what are the local residents there saying?
Ray, the local residents say that they felt something, but they're not sure if it was in fact an earth tremor. We do know that this is a mining area, and we've seen a lot of problems in this area with regards to that. They say they're obviously a bit concerned, but this is something that the minister and the NEC said that, you know, this is something that was not due to the bridge, as if it was something with a structural problem. So the residents and motorists should not now be scared to drive in this area and think that, you know, that there might be something similar at a later stage. The Transport NEC, Ishmael Badi, just told Eyewitness News that everything will be okay, and they are inspecting all the bridges in that area.
Mia, the minister visiting the injured of the collapse in hospital today. One person still in a critical condition.
That's right. A representative from the minister's office, the MEC Ishmael Vadi, he was the one leading that delegation to the hospital. They first went to the Germiston Hospital, where a husband and a 17-year-old girl, they were initially admitted to that specific hospital with the husband's wife. But the wife was then transferred to another hospital in the Randfontein area due to the severity of her injuries. Now, we understand and we followed them to that hospital. And, Ray, they say that she's now in a medically induced coma. She's got severe injuries to her legs, her ribs, and as well as to her head. So at this stage, she is critical but stable, and they are a bit concerned. We are also speaking to her husband, who was not initially aware where she was because he was still in the hospital in Germiston. But they are now going to keep the two in touch so that they know what's happening with her condition.
Eyewitness News reporter Mia Lindeke on the line from Bedford View.
SMS us on 31702 or 31567.
Some of your SMSs. One says, Ray, it's not only assault, it's also a case of public violence. And I think you're quite right. That's the Deputy Education Minister. He's appearing in court as we speak at the moment. They have to now formulate those charges. They need to decide, is it GBH, which is grievous bodily harm, or is it common assault, and also is it public violence? I may be wrong, and maybe some legal experts can also SMS in. GBH, I think, does carry a mandatory sentence, but I may be wrong. Maybe some legal experts can SMS in. Now, the SMS says, Ray, where's our wonderful ANC Women's League? That's from Pam. Well, I have an answer from you, Pam, because another SMS says, hi, Ray, is the ANC Women's League still en route from Kimberley? And that is why they're not at the Randburg Magistrates Court. Selective protesting regards from Reginald. Maybe that is the point. Maybe that they are on their way from Kimberley, or maybe they should be there. Maybe they didn't know about it. Maybe the ANC Women's League would like to let us know.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
The inquest into the death of Ahmed Timol resumes today. Witnesses are being recalled by the judge to provide clarity on discrepancies he's identified in the evidence. The anti-apartheid activist died in 1971 after falling from the 10th floor of the John Foster Square police station. The family saying that it was not suicide, the former security policeman saying it was suicide. So the inquest is now trying to decide or find out exactly what did happen back in 1971, almost 46 years ago. On the line is Eyewitness News reporter Barry Bateman. Good afternoon, Barry. New witnesses have come forward. How did this happen then?
Well, indeed, Ray, quite encouraging information being revealed in court today. When Judge Billy Motley adjourned proceedings a week ago, he made one final call to the public. He appealed, anybody with information which may assist in this particular inquest, please come forward. Now, we've heard that several witnesses have come forward, including former security branch officers. They've contacted both of the NPA advocates, Turi Pretorius, through his offices. They've even called the judge's registrar saying that they're willing to assist. Now, it's not simply as easy as that. They need to firstly consult with these witnesses, get their versions, see of what value this particular information exactly is. But Judge Motley making it quite clear, he doesn't want somebody who was in the branch but had only heard something as hearsay. They're looking for people who were in John Foster Square police station on that day in October 1971, somebody who might have seen something firsthand or have a direct link to this. He's made the point that this is not an open-ended process. They want to wrap up the evidence by next week so that we can get some arguments and close this inquest.
But, Barry, there have been several discrepancies, like you say, and a second witness testifying about the time of death being in the morning. What exactly did he say?
Well, right, quite right. We had Abdullah Adam came today to testify. Now, he was working at the petrol station across the road from John Foster Square on that particular morning, and he says that his boss called him about John Foster Square. He said he went across the road and he saw a body lying in the shrubbery next to the building. Now, he was questioned about what time this happened. He says, well, it was just as he had asked for his tea that morning. What time was tea? He says 10 o'clock. So the difficulty here is that the official time of death is sometime after 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And the death, according to the security branch, was in that particular time. So, it creates this difficulty for the judge on to establish exactly what is the time of death. If it is, in fact, as Adam says, it was in the morning, which is another witness has claimed exactly the same thing, it could advance the argument that Timor was killed in the morning and they hanged onto his body or kept his body for a certain period of time as they concocted a version. Now, to provide clarity for this, the judge recalled a forensic pathologist, a professor in Niger, to come and testify here. Unfortunately, it wasn't much help. Given what was recorded in the original pathology report, it didn't provide any of the finer details on either exact time of death. And he also said, based on what they had available, you wouldn't be able to narrow it down. Anything from an hour to several hours, from within 30 minutes to a 24-hour period is the best you can do, which doesn't provide much clarity, Ray.
Eyewitness News reporter Barry Bapen on the line from the Pretoria High Court. It's just gone 12:30.
The Midday Report. Business.
Well, the Labour Department says it has now started to inspect 72 JSE-listed firms to ensure compliance with employment equity laws. It says South Africa's employment equity law aims to remove unfair discrimination and also accelerate diversity in the workplace. The department says any company that breaches employment equity laws could face a fine of 1.5 million rand or be liable for criminal prosecution to enforce compliance. In other news, Eskom is to start selling more of its surplus capacity as the new plants come online. Eskom's acting CEO, Johnny Dadla, says the company's aging power plants have benefited from a better maintenance program, helping to improve plant availability. This marks a shift from 2 years ago when the company had to conserve power because of shortages. Dadla says Eskom has adopted an aggressive plan to improve volume sales by encouraging annual growth of 2.1% in local demand and an 8% improvement in export sales over the next 5 years. And Transnet has won a bid to recapitalize the government-owned National Railways of Zimbabwe with a $400 million US deal. Board chairperson Larry Mavima says the financially struggling NRZ will begin contract negotiations with Transnet next week. Looking at the markets, your share up a short while ago, about 0.06% at 56,014 points. The banks were down, though, about 0.5%, along with industrials taking pressure. The rand has still not recovered after coming under pressure due to the motion of no confidence. It's now 13.35 to the dollar, 17.13 to the pound, or 17.34 rather to the pound, 15.65 to the euro, and gold is $1,279.05. Brent crude oil is $52.90. More business news with Bruce on The Money Show this evening.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
The battle of online entertainment continues. Disney has announced that it wants to launch its own streaming service and will say goodbye to Netflix. Well, critics say Disney has arguably the top library of content. So what does this mean for Netflix? On the line is editor-in-chief of Stuff magazine, Toby Shapshak. Good afternoon, Toby. Welcome to the show. Will this dent Netflix and have a great selection?
Well, it's an interesting development, isn't it? Because until recently, it was very hard for traditional broadcasters to port their content to the internet, to use the internet's phraseology. So it was very easy for them to publish the content the way they normally did or broadcast it through cable in America or satellite as we use it here. But because the internet has matured to a point where it's easy for anyone to publish it themselves, someone like Netflix is kind of like a traditional broadcaster. They don't really need them. They can go direct. And the reason they're going to do that is because the money they can make from doing this directly is obviously going to be more than the money they can make from handing it over to Netflix. And obviously comes with a whole bunch of other useful things, which is they have direct access to the consumer. If they want to upsell something to the consumer, they can. They have all of those details. They have that relationship, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a move that I kind of thought would come for a while. Hulu is another big US-based streaming service that the broadcasters themselves put together. Mm. And it makes perfect sense for someone like Disney, which owns ESPN, which is a massive sports property, to do this themselves. And this is the first, I suppose, of many such initiatives that we're going to start seeing. You know, the BBC has their own system called iPlayer, which is slowly starting to be more international, not just British. So it's the beginning of content owners, as people like Disney are called in the industry, of owning the means of production or the means of distribution themselves, not relying on Netflix, not relying on a traditional broadcaster to deliver the content, and being able to do it themselves, because, you know, people have a decent internet connection, they have fiber, or they have Wi-Fi there, they can download things to their phones. This is the beginning, I suppose, of the content holders taking back their connection to the consumer.
But Toby, isn't it difficult? Because I don't know about you, I can't afford Netflix and Disney and Apple, and the list goes on. I can only afford one.
Yeah, that's the logic, right? Most people only can and would only really want to have one streaming service. There's, you know, it makes sense to get it all in one place. But unfortunately, you know, the Disneys of the world, the Hulus, the Netflix, they all have their own separate agendas, which is to grow their own business and to capture as much of the market as they can. So what we might start seeing is, you know, you might have to have, if you want to watch sports and you know, you're in the States, you're going to have ESPN. If you want to watch the Grand Tour, the new Amazon-created version of Top Gear, then you have to be on Amazon. Mm. That's the way things are starting to coalesce. I mean, it's interesting to just think about how all of this changed, right? When Netflix first appeared, it was considered where you pick up what the industry calls the back catalog. So all those old seasons of Game of Thrones or The Sopranos or Absolutely Fabulous, whatever it was that people wanted to watch, that was available on Netflix. Netflix was kind of like a repository of the old stuff that people didn't watch anymore.
Yeah.
But that has changed significantly. Netflix now spends $6 billion a year creating its own original content. It isn't a repository anymore. It is a manufacturer of the kinds of TV content that people want to watch. Same with Showmax. Showmax, the Naspers streaming service that's very strong in emerging markets in Africa. They have a pure play internet service in Poland that is very interesting and perhaps provides a model of how say a MultiChoice or a DStv could evolve themselves from a traditional broadcaster to an internet-based broadcaster. So all of a sudden, the streaming services which used to offer the old content are now producing their own content. Showmax, sorry, is producing a new a show with the woman who does Suzelle. You know, that famous YouTube.
Indeed. I certainly have seen it. Toby, going to leave it there, I'm afraid. Toby Shapshak, editor-in-chief of Stuff Magazine. Very interesting. Does anybody actually like Game of Thrones? Maybe one or two people out there? 17 minutes to 1 o'clock, and women's rights groups say the re-establishment of sexual offences courts will restore faith in the criminal judicial system. Yesterday, hundreds of people, mostly women, marched through the streets of Cape Town calling for an end to gender-based violence. They also want women to have better access to the justice system. The Justice Department is in the process of re-establishing sexual offences courts. On the line is researcher based at Wits University, Lisa Vetten. Hi, Lisa. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Madeira Report. Are you confident that the new sexual offences courts will be adequate?
Well, I think they're going to face a real struggle in that, as you know, following the ratings downgrade, there is now financial austerity throughout government. And that obviously has affected the degree to which these courts can be rolled out extensively and the range to which they're resourced. And obviously the extent to which you're going to be able to employ people who have the necessary specialist skills to be able to make those courts effective. So I think the ratings downgrade, we might not have thought it had an impact on sexual offences, but it most certainly has.
Just looking at the broader picture as well, I mean, there's also criticism that protection orders are not adhered to by the police or enforced. I mean, the whole system looks to be a little bit weak.
The system is weak. I think there were... We had reached a bit of a peak a couple of years ago, and unfortunately over the last couple of years, things have declined. some of that has to do, obviously, with budget cuts. I think it has to do with some of the infighting that's been going on in the criminal justice system or our justice authorities that have diverted attention away from the ordinary, everyday crimes that men and women experience. So I think we've lost focus there. And, you know, sometimes people who have not necessarily got the right skills but are politically connected have been appointed to the wrong positions. So I think when you add that political environment to the difficulties that are already there in trying to deal with an under-resourced social welfare system in relation to domestic violence, you don't provide very effective help.
So then, Lisa, what would you like to see from the Justice Minister?
You know, I would like them to sit down, I think, and have a dialogue with all those within the sector and the NGOs, talk about where do we go from here. If we've got budget cuts, what's going to be our priority? How can we also improve without necessarily having to spend money? I think many organizations do work within the courts and can see what the problems are. So I think can give some practical first-hand experience. So I think that's sort of a discussion where we share and pool knowledge around what we think could work, what is definitely not working, could help, I think, create a more collaborative environment in trying to go forward. I mean, at this point in time, I think government departments largely work in isolation from each other, as well as in isolation from various civil society groupings. Whereas if we all sat down and shared knowledge and tried to work together, we might see a difference.
Lisa, are sex workers adequately protected by the law?
Well, no, they're not, because what they're doing is illegal. So, of course, if they require the law's protection and they have to reveal that what they were doing was selling sex, then clearly they run the risk of prosecution themselves. So no, the law is not at all adequate in relation to their needs.
And looking at these sexual offences courts, where would you like them to be situated?
You know, I think, because I just finished some research looking at this question, I think if we're going to have to prioritise, we will probably have to first start off by placing these courts in your biggest centres that have the most number of rape cases, because that's when you can really dedicate people and you can just allow that court to function, focus exclusively on rape cases. When you get into smaller towns which have fewer rape cases, you need to work out a different system, and I don't think we've reached that system yet. So at this point in time, I think what's happening is that the Department of Justice is often establishing courts where they have the space to be able to set up a sexual offences court. And those are not necessarily the courts with the highest volume or the greatest need. So I think we have to try and look at, again, if they don't have space to set up intermediary rooms, one-way mirrors and the like, how do we create that? What do we do with that existing court environment to make it more victim-friendly? So I think what we also have to do is realize that there's no one-size-fits-all approach here. We could do some things in big courts where there are lots of victims who require those services, but we need to think in more flexible ways to ensure that justice is still available, even if it doesn't look the same as a sexual offences courts, but it's also there for those who are perhaps in smaller regions and smaller courts.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Researcher based at Fitz University, Lisa Vetten, thanks for your time this afternoon on the Midday Report.
The Midday Report on your number one news and talk station.
Let's go to Kenya now, and several attackers with machetes have been shot by Kenyan police after they stormed a polling station in Tana River. It's not yet clear if anyone was killed in last night's shooting. On the line is Eyewitness News Kenya correspondent Voldy Korosa. Hi, Voldy. Good afternoon. Just take us through exactly what happened then.
Good afternoon, Ray. Now, you'll know Tana River is quite close to the border with Somalia and has suffered several attacks from insurgent group Al-Shabaab. And police believe that this was linked to that. Several attackers, as you say, storming a polling station. Police say they killed two of them, but no civilians in Tana River were killed during that attack. Several people, however, were injured.
How peaceful have the elections been so far then?
That's an interesting question, Ray, because we had observer missions giving their preliminary reports. Former U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's in the country. We had former Ghanaian President John Mahama, as well as former South African President Thabo Mbeki, saying largely the Kenyan elections were peaceful and credible. They commended the Electoral Commission on the process, on the voting system. You'll remember that this is the first time that Kenyans voted completely electronically. They're saying that the tallying as well as the voting process on the whole went rather smoothly.
So, Voldy, no early results then?
Definitely. I mean, President Uhuru Kenyatta has maintained his early lead at 54% and being trailed by his opponent, opposition leader Raila Odinga, somewhere in the 40s. That kind of changes. But these are preliminary results that haven't been verified by the Electoral Commission. What we are waiting for now is the verification process of that results. We do understand that at county level, that kind of provincial level, so us, the Electoral Commission are going to release that result this afternoon, and consequently we have seen celebrations in places like Eldoret, in places like Kisumu, in the west of Kenya, as these results come in, because according to me, I think the contestation at that local level for positions, for local councillor, if you like, it's known as an MCA here, has been very, very fierce. I think even more so than for the presidential candidates, to be honest with you. And so celebrations have erupted sporadically in those places where those results have already been verified. We are waiting, of course, for the verification of the presidential results.
Eyewitness News Kenya correspondent Volde Karlsson on the line from Nairobi.
702 and Cape Talk.
The Midday Report.
A shocking story emerging from Yemen. The UN says people smugglers have deliberately drowned up to 50 migrants, mostly teenagers from Somalia and Ethiopia, off the coast of Yemen. On the line is our Africa correspondent, Jean-Jacques Cornish. Hi, Jean-Jacques. Welcome back to the Midday Report. Just take us through exactly what happened.
Well, Ray, there were 120 people forced into the sea when these people smugglers saw what they thought were authority figures on the beach. So they figured they'd be in trouble, throw the migrants overboard, and then they turned around and went and got another load of them. So that's how cynical that was. Well, many of these migrants obviously couldn't swim, and at least 50 drowned. 29 bodies buried by some of the survivors were found by staffers of the International Organization for Migration, that's the UN body looking after migrants. But it's just an indication of how careless and how much disregard these smugglers have for human life. That area now of Yemen is very popular for people seeking the more lucrative life in the Gulf states. And they cross from the Horn of Africa, from Somalia. We understand that there have been 55,000 of these Yemeni-bound migrants this year alone. It's much smaller than the move from Libya, say, to Italy, you know, where the figures go up as high as 600,000 since 2014. But it's again, an indication of how desperate people are to seek a better life off Africa. And it's very dangerous, not only for the crossing, the sea crossing, which is relatively narrow, but because there's a fighting in Yemen. And we did have a report in March that 42 people had been killed by a Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. As I say, once again, illustrates just what people are prepared to face to find a better life. Maybe safety, maybe security, maybe economic advancement in off Africa.
Jean-Jacques, has there been any sort of clampdown on these people smugglers?
Well, no. I mean, we're the Italian Navy's now acting, certainly in Libya, and the United Nations has backed them. But the thing is, they've got the vote in Italy to go and do it, and they sent a gunboat straight away. But the Libyans then said, enough already, you can't have gunboats in our waters. So they had one, and they were going to send six, because that's the only way of doing it, is literally being within sight of the beaches before they, so they have to get into territorial waters to do it. But there's no indication of just what impact that is having. It's only a week old, though.
And, of course, some European nations closing their doors and saying, no, you are not welcome.
Well, you know, that's the problem, and that's the problem why Italy's feeling it up north. You know, Yemen, obviously, not fully able to control things because they've got a serious security situation themselves. The Saudis are pretty tough on keeping their borders closed so that people not, you know, from Yemen into Saudi Arabia maybe try to get to some of the other Gulf states too. All of them would be very happy to receive some people prepared to do menial labor and the jobs that the locals themselves don't want to do. But the in terms of Italy, they have to take these migrants, put them up on places like Lampedusa, the island, and which is bursting at the seams. And they say nobody's helping us. The Coast Guard has to pick up these migrants. Nobody is helping. Médecins Sans Frontières, a non-governmental organization, is working. But once they get them, they can't move on anywhere else. So that's the problem.
Yeah, bit of a problem. Africa correspondent Jean-Jacques Cornish, thanks for your time this afternoon. And Proteas coach Russell Domingo is pondering his future. Cricket SA is already looking for a new coach, with his contract coming to an end with the Tour of England. So that means this is his last paycheck coming up at the end of this month. On the line is Eyewitness News sports reporter Carl Lewis. Good afternoon, Carl. 4 years at the helm. Now it's time to go. Sport's a very cruel thing, isn't it?
Good afternoon there. Indeed it is. And a life of a professional coach is definitely not easy, and the rewards are high, but just as soon as you think you're doing a good job, you could be fired. And well, after a tough tour of England, it seems that the English bowling coach Otis Gibson, he seems to be the front runner, Captain Faf du Plessis confirmed today in a press conference when they arrived. He said that the coaching panel, which was made up of Gary Kirsten, Eric Simons and Norman Arinzer, they recommended that Otis Gibson be the next coach. And this just needs to be signed off on the board. And we tried, EWN Sport tried to speak to CSA. We haven't got hold of them just yet. But Russell Domingo said he can't comment on the topic, saying he had a couple of meetings to go to. So we still need confirmation from CSA itself. But very interestingly, Faf du Plessis was quite open and honest about Otis Gibson and the coaching situation.
So then, Cole, what happens to Russell Domingo? Could he go to SAA? Are there other opportunities for him?
I definitely think there was rumours floating around that he did want to step into the SAA role a couple of months ago, but I'm not sure. I'm sure there's definitely a couple of domestic jobs that could be open to him. And also, he, like Mickey Arthur, he's coaching Pakistan. Now, he could move overseas and take up a national job elsewhere. So I'm sure for someone who's done well with the Proteas, his options won't be too short. And I know the Proteas players themselves, they rate Russell Domingo quite highly.
Eyewitness News sports reporter Carl Lewis on the line from Cape Town. Before go, some SMSs. One says, hi, we've just had another two tremors in Primrose, Germiston in the past 15 minutes, and I've lived here for 69 years plus. Then another SMS also says, another tremor in Elberton. So that's very interesting in the light of what happened with the bridge earlier on this week. And this, finishing on this SMS says, Game of Thrones is hugely popular, Ray. Where have you been? Laugh out loud, DM. Well, DM, I was just joking with you. Of course it is. I love those dragons. I love the way they just decimate the enemy. It's 1 o'clock.